We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Axel Merk. He's the founder, CEO, and CIO of Merk Investments, and he's also the author of the book Sustainable Wealth. Thanks for joining me today, Axel.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Excellent to have you as a first-time guest here. So the ECB press conference was today, and Lagarde opened it on a positive note and mentioned that the EU is exceeding pre-pandemic GDP. So how do you view this? And is it a direct result of the ECB's intervention? And maybe add how sustainable you think it is.
Well, let's talk about the exciting ECB to make sure that we don't lose any listener whatsoever. let's take a step back. We do have Christine Lagarde at the helm of the ECB these days. And as many of your listeners probably know or remember, she used to be French finance minister. She used to be head of the IMF. She is a politician running a central bank. They recently also rejuggled their mandate. Unlike the Fed, they can rejuggle their mandate in which way they want, as long as the majority there says that it's in the interest of the EU. And so they have included climate change in their mandate, not just whether institutions can go up in flames, but also to potentially allocate credit based on how green things are and how social they are. So that's the context here, right? And in the pandemic, just like any other central bank, they formed the market, printed lots of money. A little different from the Federal Reserve, when there was a tiny uptick in credit spreads, so what the less worthy borrowers pay versus the Germans, in particular German bonds, they increased the bazooka further. And so it's in that context that when today they said, oh, we'll reduce, I'll adjust our purchases a little bit, we won't call it taper, that is actually quite noteworthy. So she's been more optimistic. She is going to print a little bit less. And ultimately, though, she said it is about the quote-unquote financial conditions, which is the code word for the credit spreads. So if everything runs smoothly, they are okay, printing a little bit less, and they've increased their growth outlook. They actually think that they'll be okay for the time being anyway.
So how much of this let's say, this quote-unquote recovery, this exceeding the pre-pandemic GDP, is a result of their reaction?
Well, the pandemic is not a monetary phenomenon. We can argue about all kinds of reasons and causes, but you don't really change the course of the pandemic. And one of the big challenges is, obviously, everybody tries to help, and the one way central bankers try to help is they print money. The challenge is that in a pandemic, and we still have that, parts of the economy are shut down, meaning we still have supply issues. And on the other end of the spectrum, we try to help people, which means demand is there on many things. And that, of course, provides a dislocation, which in economic terms means inflation, right? And so the more you push, you put the pedal to the metal, the more of these distortions you're causing. And the central bankers are arguing, hey, it's transitory. We'll get through this. They're providing the support that's needed. And clearly some sort of support was needed, is needed, and whatnot. And but you asked how much are the central banks kind of to credit for any of this. I think for that, we have to go back to the March of last year, where the wheels were falling off. And in fact, the wheels were off. There was one night where overnight markets went completely berserk. You had some currencies move 10% in seconds. The bazooka at the Fed wasn't on because people were asleep in the US, right? And so once we somehow got the wheels back on, and ever since then, we've not looked back, and asset prices have moved higher. And so there, in that moment, I think central banks can do something to patch up a system that's falling apart. To what extent they can be credited with a recovery, I don't know, because obviously as you allow people to go back to work, well, they'll be productive again, right? What is not productive is to just print money but not allow them to produce anything, because when you do that, then it's impossible to create value.
Can you also explain why she said that the banks will need support? And if they don't get it, how does it affect this recovery?
I can't explain that, because the way she said it made no sense at all. She was going on a tangent in some ways about the consumer in the EU, that the consumers had taken on more debt. And if for whatever reason the recovery would stall, those consumers who are over indebted might cause a problem. And because of that, we need to help the banks now. So that's what I can, I'm the messenger here, right? I cannot explain why that makes too much sense. Obviously, European banks have lagged behind getting their act together on many things. They still have bad loans and whatnot. Central banks can keep them afloat. That's what central banks do. But to justify a particular policy because some consumers are taking on too much debt, I did not follow that logic with Madame Lagarde.
So in this vein, Axel, you had a chart in your most recent business cycle report showing that lending standards in the US have eased on an absolute basis and are currently at extremely low levels of, let's say, prerequisite. So does this, in your view, bode well for the business cycle to help to get cash to those in need? Or is it possible that this is maybe too little too late, considering how much damage has been done to the existing businesses during the initial tightening of the lending standards at the beginning of the pandemic?
Well, what central banks can do, they can provide so-called accommodative conditions, right? And there are two ways of measuring that. One is just on market spreads. And so anybody who is big enough to have access to the market, yeah, that's what the Fed can do, and ECB in Europe in particular as well. The other one is if you have to go to the bank and get a loan, right? If you run a restaurant and want to have a loan, it's kind of difficult. And so it's especially smaller business has been suffering a lot. In Europe, a lot more people are getting loans from banks, and so they've had more challenges doing that. And then that's why they kind of try to provide the sort of support they're doing. Clearly, when there's a shock from whatever nature it comes, in this case, it was to a great extent, government mandated shutdowns. Yes, some businesses will fail, right? At this stage, and by the way, the recession was very short. The recession ended probably in April last year, because you don't call the recession until you fully recovered. The moment you have a positive growth, you're out of the recession. And so we've had a lot of businesses start up and whatnot. Far more important than what a central bank does is, in my view, the confidence and predictability in policies. As you may recall, throughout this pandemic, rules were changing all the time. And then once you know what the path is, you can plan for that, right? I mean, if the future is bad, well, as long as you know what it is, you can plan for it, right? And that's why every year we complain about regulation and this and that. Well, regulations aren't as bad as uncertainty about regulation. And so that is why it is so important to plan. And that's why businesses have been created. Now, for many businesses, it might be too late. We have this environment where big business has been doing quite all right, where small business has suffered far more than big business in the environment we've been in.
So is this accommodative, monetary policy environment that you're talking about, is this an effort to stimulate the monetary velocity? And if you could give us your thoughts on how monetary velocity affects inflation as you see it.
Well, sure. I mean, you can take a horse to the well, but if the horse doesn't drink, then not much happens, right? And so the sort of thing that's been happening is central banks have been printing all this money, but in the Federal Reserve in particular, they've also been sterilizing a lot of this because there hasn't been a pickup. And so every day we have these so-called reverse repos where the liquidity gets mopped up again. And so in order to get inflation in earnest, you need to have the velocity of money pick up. You need to have people use that money. The all modern economies are based on fractional reserve banking. Central bank provides base money, but unless the kind of credit takes place. And it's in that context when I hear lots of enthusiasts about digital currencies. I'm not so thrilled if central banks get into that business, because then they have new levels. They could theoretically at least cut out the middlemen. They could have money expire, do all kinds of things to really force people to use money. For the time being, you need to have a demand, right? A credit demand. And again, what we had during the pandemic, in many ways, governments overcompensated with these various handouts. I'm not suggesting that they weren't reserved to various areas, but it overcompensated a little bit. And then, so yes, people spend money, and at the other end of the spectrum, you can't, the procurement channels are clogged up. And then, so that has created some bottlenecks, which provides inflationary pressures.
So you actually beat me to my next question, Axel, about central bank digital currencies. So in a way, if they try to push this time preference forward for spending this currency, and you know, as you pointed out, as part of your covering the ECB meeting, Lagarde pointed out that she didn't mention that inflation expectations are a driver of inflation. So talk to us a little bit about the way that they could actually fine-tune and really use a central bank digital currency to spark even velocity if they wanted.
All right. Well, you touch on many, many topics here. So first, take a step back. She tried to explain inflation, and she talked about base effect, supply shocks, and services. Base effect is a fancy term for saying, hey, if the price of oil goes up from one year to the other one, that's inflationary. We don't care about that as a central bank. The second one is what we talked about, the supply chain disruptions. You hold back one end of the economy, you push the other one, that creates inflation. The third one is she claims that because it's more expensive to provide services, meaning you have to do all kinds of checks and more processes, that pushes costs. What she didn't mention is, in my view, the key driver in the medium term about inflation is inflation expectations. It's a bit of a circular argument, but if people believe inflation will be higher, they'll push up prices. We just, as we're talking, Walmart announced that these quarterly bonuses that they paid, they'll wrap them up into the base salary. And so it becomes permanent, right? And those sort of things are going to be more inflationary pressure. And so at the other end of the spectrum is your question about digital currencies. Central banks are notoriously conservative. Now, you may not think so because they can create bazookas out of thin air and whatnot, but they love fractional reserve banking. Anything that touches that in any form or way scares them to death. The Chinese are a little bit more flexible, and so they may show us the path because they can change their mind and just change something else and do something else. And with this, if you cut out the banking system and were to go direct, I mean, you can do anything. You can tax people directly. You can fine them for jaywalking. There's all kinds of things you can do with a digital currency. Central bankers, I think, will look long and hard at this issue. But one of the things, I mean, we had it after Hurricane Katrina. We've had it since, right? When we mail out debit cards, which we did at the time, for example, and some of the government's benefits sent out in the US right now are sent out with debit cards, right? That's an inducement to send the money faster. And of course, you can move that to a digital era. And I am just, I'm doubtful that central banks will move fast in that direction. And then if and when they do, I think we should be very scared of what they're going to do with it.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought to try and figure out what kind of control they can actually put on the economy and individuals in general with, as you say, all of that banking system removed, right?
I mean, all of that is, of course, about disruption, right? And we see all kinds of ways to try to disrupt the way that finance is being conducted. And if central banks don't do it, they might get left behind. And so that's, of course, a challenge if you have the reserve currency and want to make sure that everything remains dollar-centric. And so it's going to be an interesting thing to watch. I don't expect the central bankers to do too much too quickly there. Although we'll obviously hear plenty in the blogosphere. And in the meantime, of course, individuals will try to come up with their own solutions. Now, that space is the complete Wild West these days, and regulators have started to clamp down. One thing that regulators over the past 20, 30 years have really loved to do is to make sure they know who has the money, because they are concerned about terrorist activities, anti-money laundering, and whatnot. And so many finance startups try to waltz over them. Well, the SEC and other regulators are starting to say, all right, you guys had your fun. Now let's put some order into that. And that's going to be a very interesting space to watch, because in some ways, I think that's going to increase the interest. Probably not going to move direction many of the enthusiasts wanted to move in, but institutional interest will move up once that space gets more regulated.
So, Axel, you recently posted a chart of how long it took the Fed to actually start raising rates after the 2008 financial crisis, making the point that it is far more likely that they will keep putting it off for much longer than the end of 2021. So what is the point to keep mentioning it? Is it to float the idea in the markets to see what the appetite will be for rate hikes?
Well, we all love to go back to a normal environment, right? And just mention the pandemic, right? This is soon going to be 2 years. It's still not back to normal. It's more like what will be the new normal. So similar, central bankers always want to go back to their normal environment, whatever that is, right? I mean, we haven't been there in ages. And so I'm with that chart, I'm just a messenger, right? That after 2009, it took the Fed forever to start hiking rates. And you never know, of course, what new shock is going to come along the way. Because the one thing they know how to do is cut rates. And we have, especially with Powell, a commitment to keep rates at zero until we have maximum employment. I mean, just think about that. It's not about being in neutral. It's about having the pedal to the metal until we have maximum employment. It's amazing. It's amazing to say that. Now, part of the reason is, of course, we've had the shock, and central banking is about trying to manage expectations. And by telling people we're going to be full throttle, well, maybe that's going to impact economic activity and whatnot. I don't really believe in that. I think one should be straightforward with what one is going to do. But yes, we'll have to see whether central bankers are serious about raising inflation, because at this stage, they're coming up with ever more excuses to why inflation is transitory and all that. And to maybe just on that note, my own view on that is that because things like the Delta variant and who knows what other variant comes along, there'll continue to be restrictions in parts of the world. Especially Asia has not been very effective in kind of going back to normal. We see these port shutdowns. So we'll continue to see these things. So those sort of inflationary pressures will persist. But what I'm really concerned about is if indeed we do reach maximum employment, right? If we reach maximum employment and we have the pedal to the metal, it's going to be a very volatile environment for the Federal Reserve to try to figure out how to extricate itself from that.
Yeah, as you were saying that, it makes me wonder what they are going to consider, quote unquote, maximum employment and what their actions will be at that time.
Well, they have been redefining and moving the goalposts all along, right? And now doing social good is part of the Fed's objective as well. And they look at all kinds of minorities. And as long as any minority still doesn't have a job, it's difficult. The challenge is we don't really know what maximum employment is. We do know that some people have left the labor market for good. Be that people close to retirement who've just had it, right? And today I made lots of money in the stock market. Why bother? To a bunch of others, right? Childcare is more difficult to get. Well, if we're going to be continuing to be in this sort of hybrid environment, well, some of these folks will not go back to work because it's just too complicated. And so we don't quite know where that limit is. And over time, the labor participation rate had been going down for several decades. It was in the late Trump years that the economy was running hot enough that we were able to pull some long-term unemployed from the sidelines. But a lot of that depends on what sort of incentives they're provided to join the working world. An incentive is a broad term. It's usually when people don't have a job, they get benefits. And then if those run out, they go on disability. Well, once you're on disability, it's far more difficult to get back from that because the penalty for getting a job again from a kind of the marginal income is very difficult. So it really depends on the social framework that there is. If history is any guide, we've been increasing these benefits, meaning disincentives to work. I'm not suggesting that they're not well warranted for some people, but that's the sort of thing that makes it very difficult to gauge where maximum employment is.
Absolutely. And it just goes to show the, let's say, the unintended consequences of creating so many of these social programs. As you say, there's many people that, you know, needed help in that in the time of the pandemic and the lockdowns. And it was absolutely warranted in some of those cases, but it ends up creating this incentive to exit the labor force, right?
Yeah. There is this extremely depressing book, which is most important. It's called The High Cost of Good Intentions. And it talks about the history over the centuries in the U.S., how entitlements were first created and then increased over time, and how rare it is that there are some cutbacks on that. And we obviously, when we've seen that unfold in Europe during the crisis there, how difficult it is to pull back benefits that people were promised. People don't like that. And so what ends up happening is you spend more and more money. And if there's one thing we've learned during the pandemic, that you can spend trillions and nothing happens, right? And so politicians have really got an appetite for that. The only thing holding that back is that obviously Congress in the US, there's a slim majority and midterm elections are coming up. And so maybe in the short term, at least, there's going to be a little dampener on that enthusiasm to spend money.
Yeah. And you were recently pointing that out with Joe Biden's approval rating kind of consistently going down and especially sliding more with everything happening in Afghanistan. So how do you see that situation with the midterms coming in? I believe it's the beginning of next year, right?
Well, the midterms are late next year, but historically, obviously, when a president has less of an approval rating, it's more difficult to get things done in Congress. The prediction markets currently give a 70% chance that we'll have gridlock in Congress. Now, how accurate they are that much out, I don't know. But odds are that the pendulum swung back just a little bit, right? And that will make it enough to make it very difficult to get major things done. Now, that said, apparently both parties in the U.S. are very eager to get infrastructure spending done. And so we'll spend something. But on what happens is that politicians tend to be getting to an agreement to spend money as long as they get their own pet project funded. When it comes to raising taxes, it's more difficult. And so my guess is that while the deficits may not be quite as extreme as last year, they'll be rather substantial and in many ways not sustainable. And at the same time, the big elephant in the room, entitlement reform, I don't think it's going to happen.
So Axel, when you look at all of the data as a whole, the way you do in your reports, does this truly paint a picture of an economic recovery from the pandemic to you? Or do you see our current situation as something else?
Well, this recovery is certainly not a normal recovery, right? In a normal recovery, we talked about business failures, but consumers have not quote unquote failed. If you look at the statistics, because there have been moratoria on foreclosures and whatnot. And so the consumer credit, and it's one of the reasons I don't agree with Lagarde in Europe there, consumer credit actually looks quite good. People have money. I mean, there are plenty of people in the population that are suffering, but in the aggregate, people have money. And so businesses, we do have this very strong earnings recovery, which is kind of typical for coming out of a recession. We have accommodative monetary policy. We have still accommodative fiscal policy. We'll get some sort of fiscal drag, as difficult as that might be imagined, but relative to what we've had, we'll have less money. Importantly, we do have a reasonably steep yield curve, meaning shorter term yields are lower than longer term yields, which tends to be stimulative. And so from that point of view, and if you look at those kind of classic indicators, yes, we do have an economic recovery that is underway. And I don't really see that being dislodged here, because people want to go back to work. People want to produce, want to do things. And we're able to produce things despite government policies. I mean, there are ridiculous things in place, like continue to be travel restrictions on in areas where it shouldn't be, but people will work around these issues. What these restrictions do, be that shutdowns or travel restrictions, in many ways, they'll actually drag out the length of the recovery because we'll recover less fast, but in return faster, longer than later on. And so, yes, this is an economic recovery. It has some signs of a late stage recovery, but I don't know. I wouldn't read too much into any one of these indicators.
So, Axel, is the doomsday scenario that many analysts talk about, in your opinion, further away than many warn? You use the analogy of us being in the roaring 20s right now, but how does that end?
Yes. Yeah, so when you introduced me, you gave a title here. You didn't mention that we manage about $1 billion, most of which is in precious metals and mining companies and whatnot, which I want to just say that for full disclosure, that we wouldn't be in that business if we had an outlook that the future would be super bright and super rosy, because we do think there are some risks that could go wrong here. The way I look at the markets, I look at politics, I look at it in terms of risk assessment, right? What are the risks out there? What probabilities do certain risks have? And I respect kind of wherever anybody is on that risk spectrum. Personally, I happen to think we're in the earlier part of the roaring 20s, and with a fairly direct parallel to 100 years ago, and with the very, very big caveat that those didn't end too well. And I don't just refer to the markets, but also geopolitically. And so I am in some ways more pessimistic than others are. That said, as I indicated just before, I do think we are here in an early stage of a recovery, and according to some metrics, and the central banks are clearly still printing lots of money. And so until recently, I've been quite bullish, not just in the precious metal space, but also on equities. I've dampened my equity enthusiasm in recent weeks quite significantly. But right, people never realize how good policymakers are in kicking the can down the road. And so what I encourage people who are concerned about what's happening is to take this time to prepare for things that might be less pleasant, and not just in financial markets.
So what does this expansion mean for gold investors, Axel? Does this mean that the stock market and growth equities will be the place to be instead of the traditionally more defensive asset class of the metals?
Well, you never quite know what happens in the short term, right? Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, risk assets and equities tend to do well during economic expansions. And I know many are not comfortable with that. But so I have gotten concerned about certain valuations and whatnot. So I've substantially pared that down. But still, just from a business cycle point of view, that may not be the worst place to have some assets. Now, on the precious metal side, let's first talk about gold and then maybe the mining companies. When it comes to the price of gold, I see three major classes of investors in what we do, and also more broadly. Let's talk about the first one. The first one is a speculator. The speculator just loves a volatile market, loves a ride, go long, go short. Those guys currently love to pursue the meme stocks and the digital currencies or whatever they may call that. So we don't have that much in there. They'll come back if we have a breakout one way or the other. The other one is the diversification investor. Compared to risk assets, over the long run, gold has had a near zero correlation. Now, of late, that correlation has been a tad elevated. When we had the attempt of a sell-off, I think it was 2 weeks ago or so, gold moved the other direction. So that was in some ways healthy. We haven't quite had that benefit of that. Now, obviously, when S&P moves up, I don't mind gold moving up as well, that correlation being there. But usually these correlations tend to break down just when you think that we have a quote-unquote new normal. And so for the long-term investor, that has been a good value proposition. And then the third investor, and I consider myself mostly in that camp, is the one that buys gold because it's competing with cash. And when people look at that, people always say, oh, inflation goes up, gold doesn't move, and so forth. Well, there are a gazillion ways to look at inflation. And the way I look at it is I don't look so much on the short-term CPI. Investors are forward-looking. I tend to look at 10-year real yields, that's the TIPS yield. The different market metrics, so that's the nominal yield. We're currently at 129 in the 10 years we're talking. But then you take inflation off, inflation expectations, there's some market-based ones. And so you're currently at minus 1%, actually, as we speak, at minus 105, which is better than we were at minus 120 at the worst point a few weeks ago. And so this barbaric relic, right? This rock there doesn't change, doesn't pay a dividend, but at least it doesn't change. It doesn't take 1% away a year, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas you probably have some storage costs in the gold, but overall the gold doesn't change, and so the price of gold has been quite sensitive to perceptions and changes in real rates. And so when people ask me, well, what do you think is going to happen to the price of gold? It's really a question of what do you think is going to happen to real rates? So if the Federal Reserve is going to stick to his guns and say, we're not going to do anything until we have maximum employment, well, then my guess is the economy is going to pick up and inflation is going to pick up along the way. And that means real rates are going to continue to be negative, if not even more negative. And I don't know what the price of gold is going to be, but hell yes, I like to have some diversification that just in case I'm right. And of course, we have all the incentives in place that when we've spent so much money to debase the value of the currency. And so to me, it's a diversification play, and I'm glad I have it. But I don't buy it like the speculator that I think, oh, tomorrow it's going to double and therefore I have this particular trading strategy in it.
So considering you have that longer term view on gold, are you not really worried about, let's say, if we get a equities sell-off, that gold follows it down for the first couple of weeks or month or two? Considering you have that longer term outlook, you think gold is going to outperform in that situation?
Well, every investor, I think, should make up their mind why they hold any asset, right? If you're somebody who trades on a two-month basis that you're pointing out here, well, you better have a strategy for a two-month trading strategy. I consider my gold holdings mostly in ounces, and I think the price will take care of itself over time. By all means, it's possible that in a deflationary shock, price of gold is going to go down, and it's possible it's going to go up. I think the scenario usually that happens if we did have a significant downdraft is it's the policy reaction to a deflationary shock that is good for precious metals, right? And so these things don't the challenge with any of these things is timing the market. Right. If you are good at market timing, be my guest. I prefer to be the longer term investor to write these things out. I'm all but certain that the price of gold is not going to go down to zero, which I cannot say of other investments. Right. And so just like with anything, you've got to figure out what you can afford. If anybody who's been in the gold market knows that the space can be very volatile. So if you can't handle a downdraft, which means probably you hold too much of it.
So Axel, if you're considering that there might be a deflationary shock, like you were mentioning, are there any metrics or particular market signs that you're watching to kind of inform when something like that might occur?
Well, we had a deflationary shock at the start of the pandemic. It's not my baseline scenario right now. Now, the most likely thing that could happen is that we have some sort of market dislocation that could induce that. So one of the things we're spending a lot of time on is to look at the market liquidity. One of the things you have in the current environment, we have this illusion of liquidity, but it's really only skin deep. And so we look at, one of the things you can look at is how people that write options hedge themselves and what they do, because there you can see how they price risk. So we spend a lot of time looking at those sort of things. It's a little bit too complicated to explain here in the short term, but we think that we might get some warning signals there. No, but again, right? I mean, what sort of market timing do you want to do? We look at that. I mentioned I have some money in risk assets. Well, I look at that as a flag whether I should be more cautious, But with any of these things, right? If you get whacked with a shock in the market, usually they don't announce themselves beforehand. And so you want to be still within your comfort zone that even if you miss something, that you'll be all right.
Is this shallowness of liquidity, does it have anything to do with the reverse repo market that we've seen just spike like crazy recently?
No, it has to do with, one of the big drivers of that is Sarbanes-Oxley, which we all love to hate our banks, but we've banned our banks from playing the markets for the most part, which means they don't provide liquidity anymore. We saw that in March last year, right? They had their hands tied. They couldn't jump in. You have obvious arbitrage opportunities across markets, but you need to have huge balance sheets to take advantage of them to make it worthwhile. And the big banks aren't allowed to do that. We have exchange traded products these days where you have a market maker, but you tend to have a lead market maker that does something, and everybody else builds their book around that. If the lead market maker has a computer glitch, they step away, everybody else steps away. And so we have an exchange traded product where we see that happening and saying, well, what's going on? And it's because most people, they on the market maker side, they can, if you think about, if let's assume you're one of these hedge funds, algo trader, right? You're making money. Something comes up that you don't like. That's, oh, this is a little different. Well, what are you going to do? You push the pause button, right? So your liquidity that you're providing can evaporate in a heartbeat, literally. And so that when that happens on a bigger scale, because everybody has similar models, you can have a big problem. And at the other end of the spectrum, investors don't know how to trade anymore. You used to, quote unquote, work in order. Well, everybody places a market order, or maybe you have your computer design an algorithm. But people don't know how to look at liquidity depth in the market, and not just retail investors. We see that with professional investors all the time. They don't know how ETFs work, how to place orders there properly. So all these things are things that they, everything looks great until it doesn't.
Absolutely. So Axel, something you often talk about is building resilience beyond investments. So what does this mean to you, and how do you go about building resilience into your daily life?
How many hours do we have? As I indicated, right? I believe we're in the wrong 20s. They didn't answer well. And then we had a big mess in our hand also politically and whatnot. The best investment you can probably make is in yourself. Financially, you are a fixed income generating machine, and you can control your work skills. You can do that. So that's one thing. But you can invest in your health, right? You and I, we're both runners. I don't know where your passion comes from. For me, it was mostly default because I have four kids, and so running is kind of the one thing I got in there. Learning skills. We have a vineyard that was a great refuge during the pandemic, where I kind of tried to expand my life skills on both on building solar, automating irrigation, all kinds of things. So you just have skills that go beyond sitting on your computer and doing your investments and whatnot. Being able to think on your feet, right? If there's a natural disaster, not waiting for somebody else to rescue you, but having some skills to take care of yourself. And then building a network of friends so that if you have a crisis, somebody can help you. So the resilience means many different things to many different people. And I think we should use this time to kind of be less dependent on our social media app and the internet and be able to take any situation that may come our way. And then to maybe just the other end of that is, you mentioned I wrote a book. That book was written long ago in 2009, but I'll give you the summary so you don't need to read it. It's pretty much you should be spending less than you make. That's really one of the ways you can also create sustainability, because you spending is the problem for most people, not income. We don't need everything that we think we need. And so if we are able to have our expenditures under control, we can deal with the markets, we can deal whatever life may throw at us. And I understand that's easier said than done under certain circumstances, especially when you have health bills and whatnot. But those are all goals to be potentially thriving for.
Well, some sound advice there, Axel. Is there anything else you'd like to mention to our listeners before we wrap up here?
Well, only if they want to follow me, the easiest place is probably Twitter, where I am the most unleashed, the most up-to-date. Axel Merck is my Twitter handle. Otherwise, if you want to learn more about us, merckinvestments.com is probably a website, a good starting point. I don't like to talk about the products we have on a podcast like this, but you can find your way around as to what we do when you look there a little bit more closely. And then you mentioned some charts. We do publish chart sets on the equity markets, on the business cycle, and others at merckresearch.com. And so that's also a place you might want to have a look at.
Perfect. Axel, thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.